Are you ready to unlock the secret to youthful vitality? Meet MitoPure, the revolutionary Urolithin A supplement from Timeline Nutrition. MitoPure ignites your body's natural anti-aging pathway, mitophagy. As we age, our cells can become damaged and dysfunctional. But with MitoPure, you can recycle these worn-out cells. MitoPure is a clinically validated solution backed by over 15 years of robust scientific research. Boost your cellular energy, enhance muscle strength and endurance, and even fight skin aging, all without changing your diet or exercise routine. I discovered MitoPure a couple of years ago after diving into the science of Urolithin A. Since then, it's become a vital part of my wellness routine. For more information and to order, visit timeline.com/Hoffman. Use code Hoffman at checkout to receive 10% off MitoPure. Whether you're looking to support muscle health, enhance your skin routine, or invest in your long-term vitality, MitoPure is your scientifically backed ally in the quest for slowing down the aging process. That's timeline.com/Hoffman for MitoPure. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly opportunity to answer your questions. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. With me today, Layla Mutin, our resident nutritionist, and together, hopefully, we form a complete brain.
We try to.
One of us needs a lifeline. It's conveniently available. So, what's our next question?
Okay. This is from Renata. Renata's a longtime listener for 2 decades. And she actually wrote us a couple of weeks ago when we addressed her question. She writes, you were perplexed when I wrote that my DEXA score for my left hip neck is a negative 2.4, whereas 2 years ago, it was only a negative 2.5. Well, here's the additional info you needed. I'm an 84-year-old who hikes, walks, bikes, and skis, and I have been taking Nexium on and off for 20 years, more so in the last 1.5 years, alternating with famotidine, which is Pepcid. She says, however, I think I need the Nexium because I'm taking 40-plus supplements a day.
Okay. Yeah. So there are several aspects of this. You know, first of all, let's talk about the GERD that requires that you take Nexium with as a strong acid blocker. Now, you're mitigating that by alternating with a less strong blocker, which is Pepcid, okay?
Yeah.
But when you take 40 supplements, there is the potential for that to cause gastric irritation. So I would rather that you trim down your supplements, take less, so that you don't have to take a powerful acid blocker, which actually has been associated with bone loss, okay?
Yeah.
So generally in situations like this, when we attempt to wean people off, what do we do? Layla, what would be your recommendation if you were seeing this person?
So wean people off is, number one, get them on a GERD diet that they have to really find religion with and, 100% compliance, number one. The other thing is the addition of DG, because there is licorice, as well as another powdered supplement we like called Endofen. Those two are necessary. And the Endofen also is very, very good for those with intractable GERD. So between the diet and those two supplements, Renata should be able to wean off that next.
But what about the 40 supplements that she takes? I mean, how would you approach that?
Renata, you need to stop taking everything for a few weeks to see if your GERD goes away. And how you can reintroduce those supplements is one at a time, one every 3 days or so. That way, if your stomach discomfort comes roaring back, you'll be able to identify.
So we call this an elimination and then a re-challenge. Yeah. And we do this frequently when people report symptoms. You know, say somebody is taking 40 supplements and all of a sudden their body is, itchy and, they're experiencing lip swelling, symptoms of some sort of allergy or tongue, or they're having diarrhea. We'll say, we'll try to eliminate the most likely culprits. I mean, sometimes we have to compromise with patients. Patients will say, no, I really rely on these supplements. So what we'll do is we'll kind of go through the pecking order of things that might be most caustic. So for example, if you're taking like ascorbic acid, well, that's kind of caustic. I can take up other things.
Olive leaf.
Yeah.
Or oil of oregano can be a little bit caustic. Certainly olive leaf can be. And many people are taking supplements on an empty stomach when they should not be.
Yeah, I always take supplements with food. I virtually never take supplements on an empty stomach unless I really want them to go to my brain. In the case of, you know, things like, I don't know, like a nighttime relaxant or something like that. Amino acids or, you know, things like potentially theanine, melatonin, things like that. So, okay. So that's Go ahead.
That's for Renata. And now we've got also an email from Bob.
No, hold it. I just want to go back to the other part of her question, which is, okay, she's doing all this stuff and it's quite a high level of activity. And in fact, skiing is, you know, frankly, a little bit risky when it comes to fractures. So first of all, her functionality really bespeaks a high level of fitness, which already is a bit of a hedge against fractures, because fractures are not merely about bone density. Fractures about your gainliness, your physical coordination, your lower extremity strength, your balance, and so on. And so already she has a lot of things in place for fracture avoidance by virtue of her high level of physical activity. She does have a minus 2.4 T score, which actually is on the borderline of osteoporosis, which is interesting because that is actually on a scale where it's compared to the optimal score for a 35-year-old. So she does have a score that is decidedly lower than a 35-year-old, but guess what? She's 84. So there's another adjustment to the T-score, which is called the Z-score. And the Z-score compares you not to a 35-year-old, but compares you to a comparable aged person. And in an 84-year-old, a minus 2.4 score is a zero score, which means that you are average for an 84-year-old. In other words, this is not a disease. This is normal, okay? Not to say that it doesn't require some attention because, you know, there is a little bit more fragility.
Right. There is more fragility, but that has more to do with the NXIVM than anything else.
Possibly.
Renata, if you went from a negative 1.5 to a negative 2.4 within 2 years, that's, you know, I'm holding up the flag and saying NXIVM, we need to get rid of the NXIVM.
I'd like to see her be able to taper off the NXIVM.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
So now Bob writes about his wife. My wife is 83 years old. And he goes through the whole bone density report. And again,
it's another 84, 83. Okay.
An 83-year-old with a T-score of a negative 2.2.
Very comparable to the previous example, okay? The same things apply. It's actually not that bad. It's kind of normal.
And he lists all the wonderful supplements she's taking, all good. And Bob is wondering, should she be taking more calcium? What would you recommend for her osteopenia? She's on no medication. Osteopenia is not a medical diagnosis.
Yep.
There, I said it. Yep. Osteopenia is not a medical diagnosis. There is nothing wrong.
It's like gray hair. Gray hair is not a medical diagnosis, right?
Right. When I'm 16, I have loads of it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So exactly, Bob. Don't worry about your wife's osteopenia. It is not a medical condition. It is just fine for a woman of 83 years old and keep taking all the good supplements she's taking.
If there were a perfect medicine with no side effects at all that would, number one, boost bone density, but also demonstrably reduce the risk of fractures with no side effects at all, I would say, great, take it. However, there is no such medication. And you have to look at the risk-benefit equation in taking medication, because sometimes in a situation like this, because you have a little bit of bone loss, they'll say, well, we should take something. The problem is that you have to look at the risk-benefit equation. The benefit may be very slight because you actually have a fairly low risk of fracture. And the risk is that, you know, while many people tolerate these medications, other people have problems associated with these medications, which we can get
into. That's true. In fact, we have a question relating to that, in fact. So Teresa writes, what is your knowledge of the drug Prolia? What are the side effects? Oh, lots.
Okay. Let's describe what Prolia is, because, you know, until recently we just had, you know, Fosamax, and then we had, the Sally Actinel. Field Flying Nun drug, Boniva. And then we had Actinel.
Bisphosphonates.
Bisphosphonates. And so there was a lot of enthusiasm about these because they dramatically increase bone density. But in doing so, they may weaken bone. Initially, you may get some protection from fractures, but there's diminishing returns with the use of these drugs over a period of 5 years or more. And some people, you know, in the past were consigned to these medications forever. You know, they were taking them for, you know, 8, 10, 12 years. There is, unfortunately, an increased risk of what are called pathological fractures, which are fractures induced by the medication. If these medications are taken too long, they can also cause osteonecrosis of the jaw. So there are side effects. I'm not saying that there's no place for these medications, because occasionally I prescribe them in cases where women had, you know, very severe osteoporosis, and occasionally men. But then they came up with a newer medication, which is the Prolia. And Prolia has some Me Too drugs now, too, which work in a similar way. And they work on kind of an inflammatory pathway in the bone, because we know that inflammation has something to do with bone deterioration, and they slow that process. They too have side effects. There is a slight increase in pathological fractures, but overall they're safer. They are much more expensive. They have to be injected, which is kind of inconvenient. And they also have a problematic side effect, which can be alleviated if the doctor's knowledgeable, is that once you stop them, and generally they're used for, you know, a short duration, there is rebound acceleration of bone loss. So in order to sort of seal the deal on the benefits, you have to begin the use of bisphosphonates after them.
Because there's an increased risk of broken bones, including broken bones in the spine, after stopping, skipping, or delaying Prolia. And you could have those freaky fractures, like the unusual thigh bone
fractures.
Freaky fractures is a good
way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, because you're not falling down. It's just kind of happening because...
Like the subway car, jolts you, and you put a little more weight on one hip, and then wham, you know, you fall down because your bone gives way.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to give a little rundown to Teresa of the common Prolia side effects.
Go for it.
Drugs.com, a bladder infection, a lung infection, headache, back pain, muscle or joint pain, increased blood pressure, cold symptoms, high cholesterol, or pain in your arms and legs. This is not a complete list of side effects.
Yeah, some people feel achy. They almost get a little bit of what seems like growing pains. If you can think back to, you know, some of the times when you were a kid and you were, you know, achy and you were experiencing growing pains, because there is a kind of a remineralization of the bone rapidly. So, yeah, you know, look, I don't preclude the use of these medication. I think they're both underused and vastly overused, because they're sometimes used for inappropriate reasons to treat osteopenia, which is kind of a pre-osteoporosis. I mean, look, I understand if you have like a minus 2.4, and maybe, you know, you're a young person who had to take steroid drugs for asthma or for juvenile rheumatoid arthritis or ulcerative colitis or something like that, and you have a minus 2.4 at the age of 22, that would be a case where you might say, look, this person's going to be around for 60 more years. We better start building bone now and forestall this age-related bone decline, which is inevitable. So that might be a use case for using these medications in someone who doesn't already have osteoporosis. Okay, I get it. But I just think doctors are just too literal in terms of looking at numbers, looking at cholesterol numbers, looking at LDL numbers, looking at T-scores, and rotely applying medications. And You know, I fear for the day when we replace physicians and their judgment with AI. And it's coming because we have a lot of guidelines. We have a lot of, you know, statements that are crafted by collaboration between physicians, organizations, and pharmaceutical companies, which call for the use of medications under certain circumstances. And pretty soon we can just boil it down to formulas where you can just plug in a person's blood tests and imaging scores, and it'll spit out a prescription. And I just think that that is an abrogation of the responsibility of the physician to personalize treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. Doctors have to be allowed to critically think for their patients. And with all the wearables, Dr. Hoffman, and the direct-to-consumer blood tests, everybody's kind of taking this into their own hands and maybe going to be relying even more on AI and self-diagnosing, which I find to be extremely problematic.
Yeah. I mean, it can be empowering, but it can also be problematic because it's based on large language models, which are highly infiltrated by studies that are biased towards pharmaceutical interventions. You know, the literature is compromised. The literature is infiltrated by bias towards pharmaceutical use. And that's why, you know, we sort of need to push back against over-medicalization of what are essentially physiologic and normal conditions.
Right. And AI is not going to discriminate against the bias studies. AI is going to bring you everything that's been published. And just because something has been published doesn't mean it's valid, reliable, that the methodology isn't flawed, that there isn't a bias.
Yeah. It's, so, just, it's out there.
There we have it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's out there. So Teresa, thank you for that question. Teresa Renata, Bob's wife. Okay. Oh, this may be a good time now to hear from one of our sponsors.
Great idea. And I assure you, it's not from a pharmaceutical sponsor.
Right.
There were many important reasons why I started my FullScript online supplement dispensary. I wanted to offer you the same curated professional-grade supplement brands that I use, the ones I know and trust. I also wanted to ensure that they weren't counterfeit or expired. Recently, I've been hearing more and more about counterfeit or expired products purchased from online retailers. With FullScript, you can be confident your supplements are genuine and they'll arrive with optimal freshness and potency. Also, buying through FullScript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, and a highly rated mobile app. It's safe, secure, HIPAA compliant, and offers world-class support. Go to DearHoffmanStore.com for more information and to start your free FullScript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals, including my custom targeted protocols that combine the products I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. To get started, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They are what make intelligent medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our questions. What's next, Layla?
Okay, we've got a question here from Ivana. Ivana writes, hello, I would like to ask you about a heart condition, mitral annular disjunction, or MAD, MAD.
I love medical acronyms. MAD, right?
Yeah. So Ivana says, very bad stress test because of poor functional capacity. I'm 45. She's 127.
Did you say 3'5"? 3'5"?
Yeah.
Okay.
45.
Oh, 4'5". Okay. 4'5".
4'5" years old. Other heart functional parameters are fine. Can you advise me?
Yeah. Okay. So what mitral annular dysfunction is, first of all, this is a
disjunction.
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 Okay.
Fine. Yeah.
So this is a relatively uncommon entity. And in fact, I didn't really learn about it in medical school. It may have been that it wasn't recognized then, but it sounds like, either a congenital or an acquired problem with the ring that holds the mitral valve in place. Okay. You know, if you're a car mechanic, you know that the valves are held in place with a ring, right? Your husband tinkers with cars, right? So he knows a little bit about that kind of
stuff. Sure.
I'm not an under the hood kind of guy, but I imagine that's what, you know, mechanics encounter. And so the rings are out of shape, then the valves won't close properly, or there could be some leakage around the valves. And the result is that when the heart contracts, the ejection fraction, which is what she refers to, is not normal. It is low. In other words, the heart is not pumping adequately. An ejection fraction in a young, healthy person could be 70-80%. As you get older, it declines because the heart muscle declines in its strength. But another way that you may experience problems with your ejection fraction is if the valve is either loose, or if the valve is too tight, then you have a compromised ejection fraction. And in the mitral valve, you know, that's a problem. It can cause congestive heart failure, ultimately shortness of breath and swelling in the legs and so on. So the answer to that is, fortunately, in this day and age, surgery with a mitral valve replacement. And there's a certain point where you do it, especially when a person is young and healthy and can tolerate the surgery, but you don't do it prematurely because there may be kind of a, you know, don't, like Bunker Hill, don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. You know, you wait until it gets to a point where it really is, surgery is necessary, and then you do the surgery. So I would leave it to the cardiologist to decide that. I think that this is a matter that is not, you know, I mean, you could take, you know, things like coenzyme Q10, fine, you know, maybe you can forestall the inevitable. I think there's evidence that things like coenzyme Q10, especially at moderately high doses, you know, 400, 600, 800, could have an impact. You know, I frequently tell this story, and, you know, I hope I'm not belaboring our audience, but, you know, I'll tell the story again, is that I had a friend, and I used to come to his house, and the dogs would come yapping up at me, and there were two, they, you know, those like goggle-eyed, they're called little spaniel dogs, you know, little spaniels.
Okay, cocker spaniel, yeah.
Yeah, they're not cocker spaniel, they're another type of spaniel, but they have like goggle eyes, and they, as a breed, they're very prone to valvular abnormalities. It's known that that's a susceptibility in the breed. And then I remember one day, one came up and was barking, and the other one kind of loped up and kind of just lay down. And I said, "What's wrong with that dog?" And my friend said, "Well, unfortunately, the vet said he's going to die soon, so we're going to have to put him down. But, you know, he has a valve problem." And I said, you know, just offhandedly, I said, "Look, you know, it works in people. Try this in the dog." And it's such a small dog that, you know, you could just get like cheap coenzyme Q10, just give him like 50 milligrams of CoQ10, which is kind of a paltry amount in a human, and put it in his feed and, you know, give it to him. So, you know, a few months later, I show up at the house and, you know, the two dogs come, you know, yapping up at me. And I said, oh, I guess you got a new dog. And he says, "No, that's the same dog. It really worked, you know." So, I mean, look, I don't know whether the dog was a mad dog, you know, had MAD, but they had some sort of valvular abnormality. And it didn't fix the valve, but it helped with some compensatory increase in the pumping action of the heart to overcome the valve leakage, or the, sometimes they call it valve incompetence, an incompetent valve that's not really functioning properly. So, yeah, there you have it.
And CoQ10 is concentrated in the heart muscle.
Yes.
Mostly. Provides energy to the heart.
And before they synthesized it, the way that they got CoQ10 was they would grind up heart muscle and they would extract CoQ10 from the heart muscle. But then they figured out a way to make it outside of a biological system. Well, actually, in a fermentation process.
Wow.
Yeah, CoQ10, magnesium, D-ribose. I know these would be things for human cardiac patients that are helpful, but that's... That's a great story. I don't remember that story, Dr. Hoffman. I don't think you told it as many times as you think you did.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
Wow. Anyway. Okay. So, Ivana, there you go. You know, that's a conversation with your cardiologist, but CoQ10 would not.
Don't tell your cardiologist the dog story, please. Don't, please. It's not going to work. It's not going to go over well.
It's not going to go over well. Oh, my goodness. Okay. We have a question from Caroline. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Leila. I have a question about finding a remedy for my post-nasal drip. It only affects me at night when I lay down. I've had good results with this kind of stone root blends in the past, and I used it, but after about a month, it no longer works. So there was a honeymoon period, and now it's over. If I use it daily, I do get a little relief, but it's not as complete. Can you recommend anything that may be more effective? Now, Caroline is 75 years old. She's vegan and low carb.
Huh.
Hard to be vegan and low carb, but okay.
Yeah. That's, by the way, not a great idea for a 75-year-old to be vegan and low carb, because it's hard to get adequate protein when you're 75. You know, your appetite decreases, your digestion decreases, and it's useful to have, at the very least, you know, some ovo-lacto components to your vegetarian diet, if not some, you know, occasional fish, or perish the thought, some red meat, or, you know, use some whey protein or something like that. So I'm not particularly keen on that for other reasons than post-nasal drip. But hey, you know, certainly from the standpoint of cardiovascular prevention, there may be some advantages to a vegan diet. Also, you know, we mentioned osteoporosis. Osteoporosis, I think, fares
terrible
poorly when you're on a vegan diet. Just saying. So what is helpful?
Clear nasal spray.
Yeah, I would recommend that.
Oh,
sure.
One thing.
Sure.
Food allergens, to be able to identify food allergens. She's not having any dairy if she's vegan. That would be the first place I would point.
Yeah.
Food-wise, because dairy causes a lot of phlegm and mucus.
Yeah.
But if she's vegan, she's not having any. So it's likely not that. But I'm wondering how allergic she is to all the vegan food she's eating, if she's eating a lot of grains or if she's eating a lot of nuts and seeds.
Just an observation. Just an observation from, you know, it's not that scientific, but there is this notion of diet typing. And in terms of diet typing, as it was construed by Kelly and later taken up by Nick Gonzalez, who was a cancer specialist, but also treated all kinds of other conditions. The belief was that there was a spectrum of diets, from virtually a pure carnivore diet to a diet that was practically vegan. And certain conditions responded really well to vegan diets. You know, for example, a good approach to something like pancreatic cancer might be a vegan diet. On the other hand, when Donald Kelly, who was the originator of diet typing, it is said that he cured his own pancreatic cancer with juicing and a pure raw foods vegan diet.
Wow.
His wife also went on the same diet, and she became extraordinarily allergic. Very allergic.
Wow. You know,
she began to have hives, and she had all kinds of allergic symptoms, nasal congestion and wheezing. And from that, he deduced that there were different diet types for different conditions and different people. This is really personalized nutrition. And on that basis, he said to his wife, he said, you know, contrary to what I did, you need to start eating lots of meat, and you need to acidify your body because you're too alkaline. It was a belief there was an alkaline acid kind of diathesis. I suffered from lots of allergies and hives at one point. Oh, this is about 30, 35 years ago. And I was desperate. I was really uncomfortable with it. And I tried all kinds of dietary manipulations. At the time, I was a vegan or quasi-vegan. I had a little bit of...
You were feeling macrobiotic at
I was macrobiotic,
time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I called up Nick Gonzalez, who was a friend, you know, and I said, Nick, you know, I don't have cancer, thank God, but I said, do you ever treat anything other than cancer? He said, sure. I said, well, look, I need you to figure this out because I'm having a lot of trouble. And right away he said, I think you're too alkaline. And then he tested me and he said, yes, you're too alkaline. And he said, well, what? I said, what should I do? And he said, you need to start eating meat. And I said, oh, well, I haven't eaten meat in 17 years. I haven't touched a morsel of meat. He said, well, you need to start eating meat. I said, well, I guess I could do it, you know, a couple times a week. And he said, no, you need to do it about 2-3 times a day. I said, what should I have for breakfast? And he said, well, you could have, you know, a minute steak for breakfast. You could have some, some natural sausage for breakfast. You could, you know, I said, well, every meal I got it. He says, yeah, if you want to get rid of this, you need to up your meat intake. And, you know, then when you stabilize, you can go back on a more moderate diet, but still meat needs to be incorporated in your diet because that's your diet type. And within 6 weeks, certainly 2-3 months, my allergy symptoms abated.
Wow.
So it, you know, and I tried a candida diet. I'm sorry.
Yeah. People think that alkaline is better. More alkaline, the green smoothie all the time. No, more alkaline is not better necessarily. It's a balance.
Yep.
Acid alkaline.
So I'm not saying, look, post-nasal drip, there's a lot of reasons for it. You know, I think post-nasal drip in an urban dweller is, you know, do you vacuum your apartment? Are you responsible for that?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do it, and I'm amazed at the amount of dust. I have one of these clear receptacles for my vacuum. I have, it's very gratifying because I can see the fruits of my labor.
What it's sucking up.
And I'm now doing it like, you know, a couple times a week. And it's like, oh my God, I just did it last Tuesday. And, you know, the amount of stuff that comes into an urban dwelling is amazing. And so your nose is working overtime to repel that. Plus, on top of that, I insult my nasal mucosa by swimming. And so
chlorine.
Yeah, it's very desiccating, you know, so it's no wonder that my nose is running a lot. But it's, you know, it's mucus clearance of some of these harmful.
Yeah.
These harmful substances that are present.
And all that drainage is your body getting rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't necessarily want to stop that, but you don't want to be plagued by it either. If Caroline is having this every night weighing down, check the dust in your room. Make sure you're using an air purifier in your bedroom at least, because if you're getting this when you lay down, I'm thinking bedtime, you need to vacuum around your mattress, the railings, the headboard, the foot. You need to do all of that. And if you have a lot of textiles in your rooms, a lot of carpeting, drapes, especially heavy drapes, that's another dust collector.
Hey, Layla, how much do you charge per hour? How much do you do house calls?
I can't stand cleaning my house, but I can't stand a house that's not clean.
Uh-huh.
So I'm uncomfortable unless everything is clean. So
okay.
My husband and I trade off on the cleanup. I'm not complaining or anything, but you know, it's amazing the amount of dust.
I'm beginning to enjoy vacuuming because it's like, you know, it's kind of like a ritual and it's a little bit of exercise. You know, I recently did an article on my weekly radio program about how women who don't exercise, that's not you because you exercise independently, but if you don't exercise, there is actually some cardiovascular protection conferred by housework.
Now, yes. It is activity. Yeah.
They did not find that in men for some reason. So it's kind of sexist, you know,
Wait. I think I have a confounder that maybe they didn't look at closely enough. There may be a difference in the effort forth by a woman versus the man.
Okay.
You know, when I'm vacuuming, I'm also doing the baseboards, the molding, all of that. Whereas, and I'm not blaming my husband or anything, he does a good job too. He may not be as meticulous as me, but time than me, for example.
Right.
But I just kind of, no, it could be the effort.
That is a confounder, definitely. Because I when I clean up, it's sort of like a light touch up, but I don't do like that heavy, you know.
Yeah. Deep cleaning, and then you got to clean out the bristles in your vacuum head. You have to do all. Let me get off the soapbox.
You definitely get points. You're getting some aerobic points for that, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Do we have time for an additional question? Do we have anything in the mailbox?
Let me see here. Oh yeah, this is from Judy. What are your thoughts on warfarin, which is Coumadin, compared to other blood thinners out there? I'm a 66-year-old woman who had a pulmonary embolism at age 27 when I was pregnant and a DVT at age 48. My brothers have blood clots and apparently have a family history of them. Besides that, my health is good. I have a zero calcium score, good homocysteine, low CRP. Would you recommend another blood thinner where I don't need to check my INR?
Yeah, I think, you know, since you were pregnant, you know, presumably you're, you know, years older, maybe decades older. I think that the new evidence is that some of the non Coumadin newer generation of blood thinners are adequate for protection against blood clots. Originally, they were specifically designated for prevention of blood clots in atrial fibrillation, and it wasn't demonstrated adequately that they could replace Coumadin. But now, I think, you know, best as I can recall, although I'm not a cardiologist, that they're appropriate, that Coumadin is kind of lapsing into disuse because it's inconvenient. You have to keep measuring your INR to make sure you're not over anticoagulated or under anticoagulated. And then you have to watch out for vitamin K excess. Not that you should restrict vitamin K. This is a whole thing we've gone over many times.
It's got to be a consistent amount every day.
Right.
Yeah.
So I would say it's time to talk to your doctor about Eliquis or the other one, which is Eliquis.
Pradaxa?
Yeah, right.
Is it Pradaxa?
Pradaxa. Those are them. I mean, there are a few Me Too drugs now along those lines that are blood thinners, but those are the main ones. And I think they'll do the job for you. Now, the condition that she has, and it's interesting, her brothers have it, it is a hereditary condition called thrombophilia, okay? Which means your body is friendly to thromboses, which are blood clots. So it's kind of like, I mean, the root of the word is the Greek, you know, phile, you know, like a bibliophile, someone who loves books. A thrombophile, you know, is someone who loves blood clots. A pedophile is someone who, you know, preys on children. This condition is characterized by certain defects in clotting factors. And you can actually do a blood profile to determine if you have a predisposition to blood clotting. So after a person has a blood clot or a stroke, typically that is something that's undertaken. You do a series of blood tests, and it's a standard series, which look at various things. Actually, homocysteine is sometimes part of the equation, although it's not a very strong predictor of blood clots, so other things are more strong predictors. Mm-hmm. And then if you have, say, a factor V Leiden deficiency on your blood test, which can be detected, it means that there's pretty good reason to stay on a lifetime of prophylaxis or prevention. And some people can do prevention with merely an aspirin a day, but some people require stronger blood thinners like these.
So it's not a matter of you could take more fish oil to deal with this.
You know, I from almost the beginning of my career, people were told, you need to be on Coumadin. No, I don't want to be on rat poison. You know, it's essentially, it is. So what can I take? Well, the fish oil, you can take natokinase, you can, but they just don't reliably prevent blood clots. You know, it's a little bit like if I said, you need to be on a certain medication. So you need to be on a lifetime of Coumadin, but there's different types of Coumadin at every pharmacy you go to. You know, so like this pharmacy has Coumadin that's list strength, and that pharmacy, that's the way it is with supplements. unfortunately. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, the fish oil, like what's the dosage? What's the concentration? You know, it's not that standardized. And that's why you need, unfortunately, a pharmaceutical drug to hit the reliable endpoint of blood thinning that's needed to prevent a blood clot, because it's just less reliable and also probably less strong with the supplements.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, Judy, it's time to talk to your doctor about some of these alternative blood thinning medications.
Yeah. It's surprising that she hasn't been...
Plavix, you know, sometimes, is another one that comes to mind.
Plavix is different. Plavix is mostly for after you've been stented or after a heart attack. You generally go on Plavix. Plavix has a different mode of action. So it's not generally used for this kind of blood thinning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah.
Very good to know. Judy, thank you for your very thoughtful question. We wish you well. All right. Okay.
Well, that just wraps it up for
one.
Go ahead.
Yes. We want to remind everyone that to email your questions to Q&A with Layla is questions@drhoffman.net. That is questions@drhoffman.net.
And it doesn't have to be a sentence ending in a question mark. It could also be a comment. It could be a suggestion. Mm-hmm. It could be a correction, because we're open to corrections. You know, perhaps there are health professionals who are listening to this and maybe they have a comment or a refinement on some of the opinions that I'm offering here. And we're happy to entertain that. So this is an open forum. So questions@drhoffman.net. Also includes comments, suggestions, and feedback.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thank you, Layla. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.
This is Layla Mutin, registered dietitian nutritionist. I maintain a private practice and see patients regularly. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone and telehealth consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.